We're going to get started right now. So behalf on the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, known as ITRC, welcome to today's PFAS Roundtable Session 2, Physical and Chemical Properties, Site Characterization, and Fate and Transport. My name is Kate Emma Slosher, and I'm joining today's webinar from New Hampshire. Today's session is sponsored by ITRC and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, which is also known as CLUIN. So today, first I'm going to review some housekeeping, and then I'm going to introduce the ITRC and the PFAS resources that are available for you from the ITRC website. Next, we'll review a few highlights for today's roundtable topics, and then move into the bulk of today's session, the questions and answers with our expert panelists. So ITRC, today's sponsor, is a program of the Environmental Council of the States, known as ECOS. We're a state-led organization composed of over 1,000 individual members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. Our members participate in technical teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses such as the session you're attending today. ITRC's goal is to advance the use of innovative environmental technologies and approaches, and ITRC's work translates good science into better decision making. If you'd like to be a part of ITRC, please visit the website. On the website, you can register for teams, including our PFAS team, and learn about how you can become an active member. The ITRC disclaimer is also available on the ITRC website. If you use ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC. I'll also note that ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. Note that neither ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the material nor endorse any specific products. Earlier this year, ITRC published a several hundred page per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS, technical and regulatory guidance document. We updated a series of fact sheets and prepared 10 training video modules on the content of the guidance document. These resources were prepared by a team comprised of more than 500 professionals. The current PFAS team leaders are Bob Mueller with the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection and myself from the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. I'm going to serve as the moderator for today. For a quick reference, this slide demonstrates an overview of topics that are covered in the guidance document. If you'd like to view the document, you can take a look on the website, or if you prefer, you can actually download the entire document as a PDF. In addition, we also have 12 external files for you to access with additional detailed information associated with the topics in the guidance document. There is, for example, a table that summarizes regulatory values for PFAS in water and soil. Our team currently works to update this table about every 4 to 6 weeks or so. There's also some tables of physical and chemical properties and bioconcentration factors, which we'll discuss today. So before we get started, I want to go over just a few housekeeping items. So today's session is scheduled for 2 hours. All participants, other than the panelists, will be on mute, and you'll stay on mute for the duration of today's session. This event is being recorded for you to access at a later time on the CLUIN training page. If you'd like a copy of the slides, you can download them from the initial CLUIN training page that you were directed to today. You can also access the slides by going to the Related Links section, clicking on the CLUIN training page, and then clicking the Browse to button. If you have technical difficulties, please try to request support using the Q&A pod on your screen. Lastly, at the end of this session, please provide your thoughts about today's roundtable on the online feedback form, which will help us improve future sessions. And in addition, by completing this feedback form, you'll also be able to certify that you participated today, and then we can issue a certificate of attendance to you. I want to just review a few highlights of today's topics before we get going. We are going to be addressing questions focused on three main topics: PFAS physical and chemical properties, site characterization, and fate and transport of PFAS. And as indicated in the registration materials, today's conversation is intended to address specific questions about the content in the guidance document and our training materials, and our expectation is that the participants are generally familiar with that content. If you want to navigate to those online resources during today's discussion, you can follow the link to the ITRC PFAS webpage that's there in the related links pod on your screen. We do have other roundtables that are designed to answer questions related to other topics from the PFAS technical and regulatory guidance document. If you have any questions about those other topics, you can provide those questions to us on the feedback form, and then, of course, please accept our invitation to join us for our future PFAS roundtables. I also want to note that given the ever-emerging science around PFAS, our PFAS team is working to update the guidance document, and we expect to publish some updates next year. So if you submit a question that isn't addressed in the current document, please note that our team will plan to consider addressing that information as feasible in our upcoming revisions. So let's go into a few takeaways for today's topics. And we're going to start with physical and chemical properties. The physical and chemical properties for the PFAS family of compounds can be very complex. These properties may determine where it will be found and how it will move in the environment, and will help determine what remedial technologies are likely to be successful. Some of the physical properties highlighted for PFAS in the guidance document are solubility and vapor pressure. We want to note that some chemical properties are driven by the high strength of the carbon-fluorine bond, the shortest and strongest covalent bond known in chemistry, as well as with those properties imparted by the functional groups on those molecules. So these physical and chemical properties will help impart the chemical and thermal stability that we see with PFAS. Section 4 of the Technical and Regulatory Guidance document provides more detail on physical chemical properties. We really encourage you to take a look at Table 4.1, and that's one of those separate Excel files that I just mentioned. That table contains many physical and chemical values that have been obtained from the literature. To highlight a few, there's the organic carbon to water partitioning coefficients, or KOC values, solubility, density, and pKa's, the acid dissociation constant, among others. And of course, you can get that file from our guidance document website. The fate and transport describes the behavior of PFAS following their release to the environment, and they encompass those physical, chemical, and biological processes that influence distribution, chemical transformation, and migration. The complexity of the PFAS chemistry, and as a result, those fate and transport processes, can be a function of several things. And you can read more about the factors affecting fate and transport in Section 5 of the guidance document. For example, the document addresses phase partitioning, media-specific migration processes, transformation, and PFAS uptake into plants and aquatic organisms. As you'll hear more about today, there are select representative values for BCF, bioconcentration factors, BAF, bioaccumulation factors, and BMF, biomagnification factors, and they're all provided in the supporting documentation for the tech reg. And of course, you can find that information, which has been compiled from the literature, on our supporting table 5.1. There's many site characterization issues relevant to PFAS, and furthermore, site characterization efforts for PFAS might also come with some additional complications that we need to consider. And of course, that really includes the ever-evolving science and regulations of this emerging contaminant. So in the guidance document, you can find more information about the initial steps to be taken for a site investigation. Of course, they'll always be site-dependent, but there are some various factors to account for during PFAS assessments. Some of the things to take a look at are reviewing the retardation coefficients and travel time. The document talks about approaches for assessing plume stability, and there's some considerations for contributions from other sources. You know, source identification is a growing area in the world of site characterization, and the tech reg currently includes some discussions on source identification, talks a little bit about the current challenges, and identifies some different tools you can consider for use during your site characterization effort. So we'll get started with our panelists in a minute or two, but I just want to highlight today's format. I'm going to be reading the questions, and the panelists will be providing their responses. I'm going to start with the questions that you, our participants, submitted in advance during registration. I'm also going to include some questions that we received during prior ITRC PFAS training classes, and also include some questions that we've received from our team members. Even though we're starting with the questions already submitted, you can still actively participate today. We really do encourage you to utilize the Q&A pod on your screen. You can type your question right in that pod, and we will try to incorporate it in our responses today. We're going to try to answer as many of the questions as we can in this session. I will note we might not be able to get to all of the questions, but we'll do what we can. And to that end, we're going to prepare a digest of the questions and answers, along with a reference to the information that's in the current guidance document. And we're going to make that digest available for you in the weeks after this session. So just to recap, we're focusing on the published PFAS content, and we're not going to be addressing any questions outside the scope of the current guidance document. The last thing I'm going to add is that these roundtables are a new type of session for ITRC, and thus far, we've generally had overwhelming interest, so we really do appreciate the support from you, our participants, but we know there's always room for improvement, so we really do welcome your feedback at the end of today's session. So next, it's my pleasure to introduce our expert panelists. All of them have been active members of ITRC's PFAS team over the years. They've dedicated many hours to develop our guidance document and training materials, and they've supported or served as volunteer trainers for ITRC. So a very special thank you to our panelists for participating today. Today we have Sandra Goodrow from the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection, Chris Higgins from the Colorado School of Mines. We're joined by Hunter Anderson of the Air Force Civil Engineering Center, Ryan Thomas from GHD, and also Rula Deeb from GeoSyntech. If you'd like to read more about their areas of expertise, please head to their bios on the related links pod on the CLUIN training page. So with that, we are going to move into the heart of today's agenda, which is the roundtable question and answers. Again, please use that Q&A pod at the bottom of your screen at any time today to type in any additional questions you might have. We've pulled together a couple of slides to help support some of the questions that have already been submitted, so you'll see us flip back and forth between those during today's roundtable based on all the questions we received today. Okay, so we are going to get started, and I'd like to first welcome Ryan Thomas. Ryan, are you able to be on?
Hi, Karima.
Hi, Ryan. Thanks for joining us today. So the first question is, what are the benefits for analyzing environmental media for PFAS in addition to simply looking for PFOA and PFOS?
Well, we know the available analytical methods for environmental media offer PFAS analysis well beyond just the typical PFOA and PFOS. In fact, Section 11 of the TEC reg that's focusing on sampling and analysis describes some of the published and draft methods with corresponding analyte lists for each of those methods. So, the information gathered from a larger suite of analyte offer details on the other PFAS that may be present in the media that can be used to help identify sources based on the actual constituents detected. And we note in the site characterization section that a reduced compound list may prevent full differentiation between sources. Furthermore, in some data sets, linear versus branch isomer distinction may be important to identify if it's a part of the source determination, is to focus on the differences between the electrochemical fluorination versus the fluorotelomerization processes for dating purposes.
Great. Thank you, Ryan. I appreciate that. The next question I'd like to send to Sandra Goodrow. Sandra, are you able to come off mute?
Hi, Kate Emma. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Thanks, Sandra. So just a minute ago, I talked about BAF and BCF. Can you define them a little bit more and then talk about what about these characteristics are notable when considering PFAS?
Okay, so there are really three general operational categories to characterize the potential for partitioning to biota. The bioconcentration factor, or BCF, is the direct uptake to the organism from the water or the surrounding environment, while bioaccumulation factor, or BAF, is the uptake dependent on the environment and the diet. But then there's also the biomagnification factor, the MF. This is the increase in the tissue as it moves up the food chain based on the predator-prey relationships. So these processes are very different for the various PFAS as compared to other more familiar compounds like PCBs. We know the PCBs are lipophilic and generally partition to the fatty tissues and biota, so the more lipids that an organism has, the more likely the bioaccumulation is greater. But for PFAS, they tend to be more proteinophilic in that they partition to proteins better. This means that you'll find higher concentrations in the blood and liver and less in the muscle tissues, such as the fillets.
That's great. Thank you, Sandra. The next question I have to do for, I think it's site characterization. Hunter, are you able to join us?
I am here.
Hi, Hunter. Thank you. So, Hunter, are there any strategies for completing initial screenings at PFAS release sites? And we have an example. So for an initial site characterization at an area where AFFF was suspected to have been used, where should the samples be collected, from what media, and for what analyses?
Yeah, sure. So Chapter 10 of the TEC Reg discusses site characterization strategies and generally promotes this sort of phased approach that's more or less aligned with the CERCLA process, where step one in that process is to conduct some basic reconnaissance of the site, obtain all the relevant intel based on, you know, the relevant land use history of the site if that information is not otherwise available. And then the second phase is to conduct a very targeted and biased sampling campaign, specifically within, you know, the footprint of where AFFF infiltrated the soils, for example, or at a manufacturing facility, it would be at the presumed depositional locations. That preliminary investigation should consist of a series of soils, shallow and deep as applicable, and shallow water table samples, simply to confirm the presence of contamination above relevant screening values. And it's probably a good idea to also obtain some unimpacted samples at the same time. The Chapter 10 of the TEC Reg discusses this issue with anthropogenic background contamination. So in these preliminary investigations, that information would be helpful to determine if, in fact, there was a point source discharge of AFFF or otherwise. And then also during those preliminary investigations, because there's such an emphasis on these drinking water exposures, it's probably a good idea to conduct these potable well surveys. And we within the Air Force are using a 4-mile radius as sort of our threshold for that, and that comes out of old Superfund SI guidance, site inspection guidance. But ultimately, the idea is to eventually obtain a comprehensive lateral and vertical delineation of all of this PFAS contamination in all matrices that are relevant, soils, groundwater, sediment, surface water, et cetera.
Thanks, Hunter. And I guess I'd just ask a follow-up. What if you have a site where you're not exactly sure where the AFFF was discharged, so you don't really know that footprint? Would you change anything about your sampling strategy?
Yeah, I guess in that situation, you know, you're probably going to have to rely on, you know, some sort of a gridded approach. Like I said, again, the idea is to try and determine that there is some elevated measurable concentrations, you know, that are consistent with the general land use history. I mean, you know, if there was AFFF used in the past, it ought to be, you know, reasonably sure where that discharge occurred within reason. And you know, the more uncertain, I guess, it becomes, the more expensive the preliminary sampling campaign becomes. But eventually the idea is to confirm that there are elevated concentrations above this quote-unquote anthropogenic background.
Excellent. Thank you, Hunter. Okay, moving on. Chris, are you able to come off of mute, please?
I am here.
Great, thanks. Welcome to our discussion. Chris, Has there been any study of PFAS interactions with other contaminants, such as solvents or hydrocarbons, where the presence of both may have increased, or I guess for the other matter, for decrease, the likelihood of movement of other contaminants in groundwater?
So there's surprisingly very little information on this, particularly in light of the fact that, as Hunter was discussing, these aqueous film-forming foams can be released with fuels, which they were intended to put out when those fuels were on fire. There has been some work related to non-aqueous phase liquids or NAPLs, and broadly speaking, PFAS can both interact in a synergistic as well as antagonistic way with respect to NAPLs, in that the NAPL can enhance the stickiness or absorption of these PFAS to a solid phase, for example, but also can potentially compete for absorption sites in some systems. And all of that's summarized, or some of that, I should say, is summarized in Tech Reg Chapter 5. There has been some more recent work showing interactions at NAPL water interfaces, so I think that's one area that I think that we're going to be updating the Tech Reg document in the future. And I'll also note there was a study of a number of years ago that showed contaminants such as PFOA could potentially enhance the solubilization and therefore transport of things like PAHs. But that, as of yet, that complexity hasn't been addressed in the Tech Reg document.
Excellent. Thanks, Chris. So, you know, as you mentioned, we are looking to update the document. So if there are more pieces of information or research that come out, we certainly want to have our team those so we can keep our document current along with this emerging science. But before I leave this question, I actually want to see if Rula or Hunter have any comments given your experience. Rula, are you able to come off mute?
Yes. I think Chris did a great job of talking about the potential for PFAS partitioning into LNAPL, but it also may be useful to discuss how the presence of LNAPL may impact the fate of PFAS, fate and transport of PFAS in general. We cover this in chapters 5 and 10 of the Tech Reg. Few examples include commingling of contaminants, which has the potential to impact PFAS extent, and that's been shown in the lab via different studies. For example, sorption or partitioning of the perfluoroalkyl acids may increase in the presence of TCE DNAPL. Conceptual modeling of published PFAS data suggests that NAPL water partitioning and NAPL water interface interactions may increase retardation of some PFAS in source zones. And finally, at older sites where in situ or pump and treat technologies were used to reduce NAPL source areas before we became aware of PFAS, these remedies can complicate PFAS characterization and distribution efforts due to precursor transformation. That's all I wanted to add, Kate Emma.
No, I appreciate that, Rula. And Hunter, anything else you want to add before I move on to the question?
Okay. Yeah, just real quickly, and I certainly agree with everything both Chris and Rula said, but I just kind of want to add some context. You know, I don't disagree with the fact that there are very elegant published, you know, literature clearly indicating the interactions between, you know, dissolved phase PFAS and these non-aqueous phase liquids, whether it be to enhance retardation or to somehow accelerate it via some co-solvency effect. But and that information might certainly be relevant in terms of how we explain how these plumes developed and got to the point that they are today. But these NAPL PFAS interactions really aren't relevant to predicting future transport, specifically because a lot of this NAPL has been remediated. We've spent the last two decades really aggressively remediating NAPLs throughout this country, very aggressively. And I find it hard to believe that there are pockets of that left to the extent that it might provide a reservoir of these artifacts in the subsurface. So I think it's relevant information in terms of, you know, understanding how we got to where we are today, but I don't think it's going to be all that helpful in terms of understanding, you know, how to forecast these plume behaviors in the future once we've, you know, comprehensively delineated them, other than to understand the artifacts related to precursor transformation and our past remedial activities on the current day distribution of PFAS. Thanks,
Hunter. And, you know, you do have a good point. There are a lot of sites that have been investigated or, as you indicated, remediated for those contaminants, but for I'll also add that there might be some new sites, you know, maybe a new fire training area that's not associated with some past investigations that's coming to light. And so it's definitely something I think at least people should be aware of going forward. But there's a lot of good perspectives from each of you on this, so thank you. The next question I'd like to direct to Sandra. Sandra, what are some site characteristics that should be considered when determining the risk of leaching PFAS from soil to groundwater?
Okay, this goes a little back to basics. So first and foremost, you need to consider what the concentration of the PFAS is in the soil. So the higher levels of PFAS in the soils, the more likely they'll overload the binding sites there and be able to migrate with precipitation into the groundwater. You're also going to want to consider the type of PFAS present. So the physical and chemical characteristics of the specific analyte will indicate if they have a greater tendency to be soluble in the water and with the precipitation into the groundwater, which would make the mobilization of the PFAS by percolation of precipitation or moving groundwater much easier. And another thing you need to consider is the type of soil and the organic carbon content of the soil. So the organic carbon content of the soil is related to the binding capacity that the PFAS has, but also know that there may be other mechanisms taking place on the site that may change that binding capacity or the retardation of that mobility. The other items may include the level of iron oxides in the soil, also the level of protein in the soil. And this is an area of current research. So if you're working with this on the site, you probably want to consistently reevaluate it as we gain more information on this.
Good. Thanks. Thanks, Sandra. I know that's definitely a hot topic for a lot of people right now. Along with this next question, also seems to be a very hot topic. We've received a lot of questions about forensics. So I'd like to direct this question to Ryan. What does, I guess, the forensics, we in the ITRC PFAS team and the technical and regulatory guidance document refer to that as source identification. So Ryan, can you please give an update on our source identification approaches for PFAS releases?
Yeah, sure, Kate Emma. Well, in section 10.5 on source identification, we briefly discussed some of the advanced techniques, including, you know, chemical fingerprinting, isotopic fingerprinting, and signature chemicals. But as part of an update for the source identification section, we are going to include new and emerging forensic tools. There are a number of publications that are emerging describing these tools for PFAS sources, and in particular, there's one publication that came out this year from Bonatti, along with other researchers, that's describing a forensic approach for distinguishing PFAS materials. The article describes a tiered approach using screening tools such as particle-induced gamma ray emission, or PIGI, and isomer separation techniques to really understand the diagnostic characteristics of PFAS to help determine those sources. Really, the overall concept for the forensic tools is to first use screening to understand the general PFAS signatures, and then use standard commercial lab methods to determine concentrations for regulatory compliance, and, you know, finally evaluate isomer patterns of select PFAS. This approach, and really any others that's been peer-reviewed, will be included in those source identification updates.
Great. Thank you, Ryan. And actually, Rula, if you can come on, let's talk a little bit more about source identification. Can you discuss what methods could be used for fingerprinting PFAS, for doing the source identification?
Yes, thank you. In Chapter 10 of the TechReg, we cover the issues associated with fingerprinting very broadly, and we clearly suggest that multiple lines of evidence are needed for reliable source identification because of the complexity of PFAS composition and source formulations, along with the potential for significant formation from precursors within a spill area. All of these diminish the reliability of chemical fingerprinting. We also need information related to degradation on, and a solid understanding of case-specific conditions for defensible fingerprinting tools. With this being said, as Ryan also mentioned, the sources of PFAS could be deduced on a case-by-case basis, in particular when multiple lines of evidence are developed, and as our knowledge related to fate and transport continues to improve. Library research, preliminary identification of potential PFAS sources, and information gathered from patents can assist in the identification of PFAS. And specifically in section 10.5.1 of the tech reg, we provide limited examples of chemical fingerprinting efforts for source IDs. This is an evolving science, so please stay tuned.
Thanks, Rula. I have another question, though. I want to get a little more specific, if you can. One of the questions actually asks, is there a way to determine if PFAS were deposited from an airborne deposition source or if the PFAS are present due to transport in groundwater?
Yes, this is a very specific question. I think clearly determining whether PFAS were sourced from airborne deposition versus a point release leading to downgradient transport in groundwater is not always straightforward. It's very site-specific. In Chapter 6 of the tech reg, we talk about the presence of PFAS in different environmental media, and we show that PFAS have been found in soil and sediment at similar concentrations due to the two different release scenarios here, be it atmospheric deposition or exposure to impacted media or direct discharge. The range of PFAS types and their concentrations associated with the different sources can be the same. So again, going back to the first part of the question and using multiple lines of evidence approach to try and source the PFAS is particularly important. But it's not going to be a one-size-fits-all. It's a very site-specific exercise and following this multiple lines of evidence approach.
All right. Thank you, Rula. And to our participants, I do see there are a number of questions coming in. If you have additional questions or you'd like clarification on anything that we're talking about, please continue to use that Q&A pod to stay engaged with us. I'm going to ask this question for Ryan. Ryan, for AFFF release sites, is it possible to tie release of AFFF to a particular AFFF manufacturer and time frame of manufacture?
So I know there are a number of publications that evaluate PFAS associated with AFFF and really comparing specific PFAS concentrations. And I know we mentioned in the fate and transport section a reference from 2013 that talks about that variable nature of AFFF based on really that mode of synthesis, either being electrochemical fluorination or ECF or fluorotelomerization, FT. So, you know, given that the phase out of manufacturing of certain ECF-based PFAS is in the early 2000s, as well as certain FT-based PFAS in the 2000 to 2015 timeframe, there's a potential that the presence of ECF or FT-based PFAS could suggest a particular manufacturer of AFFF.
Thanks, Ryan. So I'm going to ask a follow-up on that. When one's trying to evaluate possible different AFFF sources, should the site characterization efforts consider the presence or absence of certain PFAS, or should maybe we be looking at ratios between concentrations of certain PFAS?
Yeah, I mean, I think data analysis and the interpretation part of site characterization needs to consider the presence or absence of certain PFAS to help evaluate those different AFFF sources. So, you know, just for instance, legacy PFOS AFFF was manufactured in the U.S. exclusively by one company from, you know, the 1960s until about 2002 and contained PFOS and perfluoroalkane sulfonates such as PFHXS. But legacy fluorotelomer AFFF was manufactured and sold in the U.S. from, you know, the 1970s until about 2016. And it includes all other brands of AFFF besides the legacy PFOS AFFF. The legacy fluorotelomer AFFF is not made with PFOA, but contains polyfluorinated precursors that can degrade to perfluoroalkane carboxylate, such as PFOA. So this is just one comparison between, you know, legacy fluorotelomer and legacy PFOS, AFFFs that can help determine source by comparing the presence or absence and, you know, really ratios between concentrations of fluorotelomers with PFCAs compared to PFOS and PFSAs. But more information on the manufacturing and phase outs are mentioned in our Section 2 and AFFF composition in Section 3 of the guidance document.
Thank you, Ryan. And we're getting some additional questions from the audience on this. So I'm going to ask Chris if you can help answer this one. And so the question is asking about identification of certain precursors. And so they're specifically asking NETFOSAA and MEFOSAA, which in the alphabet soup world, right, is a perfluorooctane sulfonamidoacetic acids. If those compounds are identified, what does that indicate about the potential source material? Does it indicate that AFFF is the only source of those PFAS? Does it indicate that the PFAS are fluorotelomers? Can you speak to that a little bit, please?
Sure. So I'll just preface this by saying there's a lot of work in this whole area of source apportionment and identifying where the different compounds are coming from. So I very much envision that the next iteration of the tech reg is going to have a lot more information because there's a lot of research being done along the topic, and Ryan already alluded to some of the publications coming out. With respect to these particular compounds, I often refer to them as the sulfonamide acetic acids, in short, rather than the full acronym there. These are electrochemical fluorination products. So these are not going to be a fluorotelomer source. These are the ECF products, and specifically they are chemical precursors to things like PFAS.
Actually, Rula, if you can come off of mute for a second so I can go on. So earlier Ryan mentioned analyzing samples for PFAS beyond just PFOA and PFOS. It was one of our first questions. So let's follow up on that. Should source identification consider a non-target PFAS analysis? Before you answer, though, I want to note that different types of PFAS analysis are covered in Chapter 11 of the tech reg, and we actually had a roundtable session on that in July. And the digest of those questions and answers should be posted soon for you folks if you're interested in that. But Rula, can you speak to this a little bit more for us, please?
Absolutely. Depending on the objectives of the site characterization effort, it is sometimes useful to consider non-target PFAS analysis. And this is covered in Chapter 11 of the tech reg. So in addition to the target analytes, which include PFOS and PFOA and are measured using modified EPA methods, there are qualitative techniques that address that non-target analyte portion at PFAS contaminated sites. These techniques range in commercial availability and most have not yet undergone multi-level validation. The data from these qualitative techniques could augment the definitive data from the quantitative methods that we rely on. The techniques include something referred to as the TOP assay, or the total oxidizable precursor assay. And this assay measures precursors that can be converted to the perfluoroalkyl acids like PFOA. Another method is particle-induced gamma ray emission, or PIGI spectroscopy, and this method measures elemental fluorine isolated on a thin surface. A third non-target method is the adsorbable organic fluorine, or AOF method, which is paired with combustion ion chromatography, and it measures the combusted organofluorine content of a sample as fluoride. And finally, we've got high-resolution mass spectrometry techniques like the QTOF, which can tentatively identify PFAS structures through library matching or in-depth data analysis. And as Kate Emma mentioned, please refer to the recording of our earlier roundtable discussion for details, or refer to Chapter 11 of the tech reg.
Great. Thank you, Rula. Sandra, if you could please come on. How can background concentrations of PFAS be identified during site characterization?
Background concentrations. Okay, so we always have to keep in mind that these compounds are man-made and that there are no natural background levels. Every environmental detection of PFAS has an anthropogenic origin. However, since PFAS is often widely distributed in the environment, it may become necessary to understand what should be attributed to a particular site and what might have originated off-site, outside of impacts from your particular site. So you go about your regular investigations, the typical evaluation of concentration gradients, considering migration pathways of on-site and potential off-site sources. But you also want to incorporate evaluation of multiple analytes of PFAS. So going back to what Ryan was talking about in the beginning, analyze your media for multiple analytes, and that's going to give you an idea of where that sample originated from, where that PFAS came from. It might kind of relate it to a particular product, and that will give you a lot of good information. And you put that together with the gradients. You could also look at the ratios of the different analytes. That will also possibly give you some indication of the original product, but you also have to take into consideration when that product might have been deposited there, because each PFAS analyte does have preferential migration pathways depending on its physical and chemical characteristics. So they're going to move through the environment at different rates. So you have to take a lot into consideration. So there's not one baseline background like you would have in a natural compound like mercury. And so instead we use the term anthropogenic background. And we recommend that along with site impact that alternative sources and secondary sources be investigated, but proceed with a lot of caution. And like Rulu was saying, there's multiple lines of evidence that you have to incorporate to your evaluation of what might be considered background for your particular site.
Excellent. Thanks, Sandra. I think we're probably able to get Chris back on the line. Chris, are you able to come off of mute?
Yes. Sorry, not sure what happened there.
Excellent. So you know what I'm going to do, Chris? I'm just going to re-ask the question and then have you try to jump in on where you think you were in your response. So the question was generally, if certain precursors are identified, the precursors they're looking at are these perfluorooctane sulfonamidoacetic acids, so you might see them abbreviated NETFOSAA and NMEFOSAA. So if those precursors are identified, what does that indicate about the potential source material? Does it indicate that only AFFF is the source material, or does it indicate that the PFAS are fluorotelomers?
So, sure. Not sure where things cut off before, but in short, these are ECF chemicals. These are electrochemical fluorination, so they're not fluorotelomer chemicals. And as to whether or not they're actually present in AFFF, that's somewhat of an outstanding question. There's a lot of work being done beyond some of the work that Ryan talked about before, trying to characterize some of these different formulations and what was exactly in them. I will say that those two compounds, those sulfonamide acetic acids, tend to be more associated with consumer products because they're likely oxidation products of sulfonamidyl ethanols, N-methyl and N-ethylfos ethanols. So my current thinking, you know, would be that those would be more likely consumer product, i.e. wastewater landfill type biosolid type source as compared to AFFF, but there's a lot more work to be done to characterize historical formulations of AFFF.
Great. Thank you, Chris. That's certainly, you know, an area where we're going to be looking for more information going forward. So let's talk a little bit more about precursors. I'm going to direct this question to Ryan. Ryan, what PFAS transform in the environment, and what are the expected terminal products?
All right, so in section 5.4 from the bait and transport section, it focuses on, you know, some of these PFAS transformations. You know, polyfluorinated PFAS known to transform are referred to these precursors, and generally form the perfluoroalkyl acids, or PFAAs. And at this point, the PFAAs have not been shown to degrade or transform under those ambient and environmental conditions. Transformation studies published to date are only for a small subsample of PFAS, and this really leads to a great deal of uncertainty, such as the extent to which transformation occurs and, you know, which environmental compartments represent the majority of transformations, as well as relevant environmental conditions that promote transformation processes and the actual, you know, transformation rates and pathways.
Thanks, Ryan. And Chris, I'm glad you're back online, because I want to do a follow-up for you right now. So Ryan's just talking about the fact that PFAAs, those perfluoroalkyl acids, haven't really been shown to transform under ambient environmental conditions. Does a change in pH do anything to change the PFAAs?
So these perfluoroalkyl acids are really not likely to transform in the environment under any realistic pH values or environmentally relevant pH values. The thing to keep in mind, and this is summarized in section 4 of the TEG reg, is that the pKa's for the perfluoroalkyl acids are generally quite low, so they'll exist as anions at pretty much all environmentally relevant pH values, at least in terms of soil and groundwater.
Okay, so Chris, I'm going to have you stay on. Could you help us understand a little bit more then under what conditions do we see environmental transformation of PFAS?
Sure. So when Ryan was talking about the transformation, you know, the conversion of these polyfluoroalkyl substances, these precursors, is possible and even quite likely. And this is generally going to be a function, though, of the various redox conditions. And so it's not a pH-dependent process necessarily. It's more driven by, is it an aerobic environment, an anaerobic environment, and that sort of thing as compared to something like pH.
Okay. So when we're talking about redox conditions, there are specific situations when a precursor can transform to those perfluoroalkyl acids.
Correct, yeah. So there's been a lot more work on the aerobic transformation, so kind of under oxygen conditions where you have oxygen present. That's a lot of the studies on precursor transformation have focused on aerobic transformation. There have been some studies on anaerobic or anoxic type conditions, but very, very, very little as compared to the aerobic types of conditions. I will note that there are some compounds, such as the fluoroethylamer sulfonates, which are precursors that are relatively stable under anaerobic conditions, and that's been fairly well documented. And a lot of this is summarized in section 5.4 of the TEG reg.
Thanks, Chris. I'm going to have you stay on. I want to send this question to you. Many sites detect several PFAAs, including the perfluoroalkyl sulfonic acids, like PFOS and PFBS, and the perfluoroalkyl carboxylic acids, like PFNA and PFOA. So when it comes to the relative rate of transport in the environment, do certain PFAAs migrate faster or slower? And if so, why?
Yes. So generally, the shorter the compound, the shorter the perfluoroalkyl acid, the faster the migration. You know, in short, pun intended, they don't stick as well to the solids or interfaces. And so when you're looking at the perfluoroalkyl acids, the chain length, the tail length, really makes a big difference in terms of transport. When you're looking within the perfluoroalkyl acids, comparing the carboxylates to the sulfonates, it turns out when you have the same actual number of perfluorocarbons, so for example, PFNA versus PFOS, each of those has 8 fluorinated carbons. In the case of PFNA, it actually has a carboxylic acid that adds, that's why it's not the C9, because that final carbon is a carboxylic acid. But when you compare them for the same perfluorotail length, the perfluorosulfonates tend to stick a little bit more than the perfluorocarboxylates. I'll note there's also some limited information about isomers. I think that's come up a little bit in the discussion, that at least when we analyze for these compounds, and there's some evidence under field conditions, that branched isomers, particularly for things like PFOS, can move more rapidly in the subsurface than perhaps the linear isomers. But I expect we'll see a lot more information about that in the coming years as more research comes out.
Awesome. Thanks, Chris. And Ryan, I'd like to just ask a follow-up question. So Chris was just talking about the relative mobility of certain PFAS. Can you use that to evaluate the leading edge of a groundwater plume in advance of other PFAS?
Well, you know, as Chris just mentioned, the shorter chain PFAS migrate faster due to, you know, their reduced sorption to solids as compared to a longer chain PFAS. Therefore, the shorter chain PFAS are more mobile in groundwater and will leach from soil to groundwater at a faster rate and result in that leading edge of the plume. Of course, other factors are in play that impact that mobility, including, you know, some co-contaminants, pH, and the overall solution chemistry.
Thanks, Ryan. And we are getting a lot of questions, so I'm really excited to see all these questions coming in today. So please keep them coming. But I am going to note, I know there are a number of questions on sampling and analysis for PFAS, and some of those questions are definitely better addressed in Chapter 11 and the roundtable session that we had in July. So if you need more information, please head to Chapter 11 for sampling and analysis. But we are trying to incorporate some of these as they pertain to evaluations of fate and transport and looking at certain site characterization approaches for PFAS. And so my next question I'm going to address to Rula. So we just talked about the PFAS chemistry. We know that these are complex. So given the complexities of the unsaturated zone and that complicated PFAS chemistry, can simple fate and transport models predict transport of PFAS in the environment, or are there any limitations to consider?
Thanks, Kate. Emma, the simple answer is yes. Simple fate and transport models can be used as predictive tools to look at PFAS transport in the environment, but it is important to keep in mind the limitations. And details regarding this are discussed in sections 5.2 and 10.4 of the TECREG. So we can model PFAS fate and transport both in the saturated and unsaturated zones. We have to keep in mind that modeling may have significant uncertainty due to things like precursor concentrations, potential transformation, and biodegradation rates. In addition, desorption kinetics of PFAS are not currently well understood. So modeling may be appropriate, but it may only be appropriate under certain conditions. And when we use models, we have to keep in mind the utility of site-specific data, which become very important for evaluating potential model input parameters like KOC. And we know that KOC can exhibit significant spatial variation. For the VEDO zone, there are models also, such as US EPA's VLEACH. A VLEACH can simulate one-dimensional vertical transport. However, models like VLEACH do not include air-water interface interactions, and that, as we've heard, is very important for PFAS transport in the VEDO zone. Another limitation is the fact that models like VLEACH have not been yet validated for use with PFAS. So conduct the modeling, but keep in mind the limitations and perform the modeling with the appropriate caveats.
Thanks, Rula. And Hunter, I'd like to bring you back on because we have a follow-up question on modeling. And so if one were to model the fate and transport of PFAS in groundwater, essentially using the approaches that Rula just discussed, are the physical and chemical properties that you typically need as an input parameter, have they been established for the PFAS of concern at our sites?
Yeah, hi, thanks, Kate. So let me just emphasize the difference here between trying to model PFAS transport in the saturated zone, the groundwater environment, you know, modeling vertical transport throughout the unsaturated VEDO zone is not even remotely within our capability to do so accurately at this point. Certainly, you know, those modeling tools exist, but they are built and parameterized for the conventional hydrophobic organics, and they don't include the relevant properties that account for the surfactant-specific behavior of PFAS. However, within the groundwater environment, a lot of those surfactant properties become much less significant, potentially to include this air-water interfacial behavior, such that as long as you have the relevant site-specific information, I do think modeling a transport in the saturated zone is a doable scenario. Specifically, the TECREG doesn't endorse any specific groundwater model in particular, but the conventional advection dispersion equations are perfectly appropriate for PFAS, especially at the very dilute concentrations that we typically encounter at our AFFF and, you know, impacted sites, which really represent sort of the worst case scenario out there in terms of the mass discharges. With that information, the physical chemical properties are relevant, and that could sort of lead you to a mechanistic understanding of the parameterizations needed to account for the PFAS-specific retardation, things like carbon chain length, the functional group, some of the dispersivities, et cetera. But an alternative is to parameterize those advection dispersion equations with site-specific or field-derived retardation values. And in doing so, you kind of account for the net effect or sort of the interactions between all these phase partitioning phenomena that we don't otherwise have an accurate accounting of mechanistically with a more theoretical type model. So I'll leave it at that. But nevertheless, groundwater, I think, is doable, but an emphasis on field-derived parameters, whereas vertical transport through the Vela zone is absolutely not doable right now under any circumstance.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a lot of information that folks are looking at. You know, we have some information in the TECREG, but it's a definitely an area of emerging science, and we definitely look forward to seeing what everyone learns from all these different modeling approaches going forward, and then how we can apply them to our sites. I'm going to head the next question over to Chris. Chris, are there any studies regarding natural attenuation or biodegradation of PFAS?
So I've already talked a little bit about the biotransformation of these polyfluorinated substances. Again, there's a lot of information on that in TECREG Section 5.4, although more is coming. I think what the question may be trying to get at is was a very recent study reporting the transformation of the perfluoroalkyl acids. This is Peter Jaffe's lab. And that is something that a lot of folks are interested in, but there's a lot more work that needs to be done to kind of confirm those findings. I'll just say if these compounds are readily transformed, I don't think we'd be looking at as large groundwater plumes as we typically are all around the country or around the world. But with that said, I think there is an interest in following up and seeing if there is actually any potential for biodegradation of these perfluoroalkyl acids.
Thanks, Chris. Ryan, I'd like you to come back on for our next question. Gets into some site characterization. So, Ryan, can you describe site scenarios where it would be beneficial to collect soil samples for PFAS analysis?
Yeah, so, well, I think there's a figure from Section 9 of the TECREG on site risk assessment. It really helps to visualize potential PFAS-impacted media that, you know, may need to be included in a sampling event, such as, you know, groundwater, surface water, sediment, air, and even soil. Some specific scenarios would be related to spills or, you know, releases that are suspect of having PFAS. And, you know, most of us are familiar, and we've been chatting today about aqueous film-forming foams, or AFFFs, that, you know, have been used across numerous industries for fire suppression. So if there's a known AFFF release, then this would be one of those scenarios that soil sampling can, you know, help focus and guide that site characterization. Something that we do mention in Section 10 of the TECREG, which is on site characterization, is the, you know, nature of PFAS sources, including primary and secondary sources, to determine really the extent of PFAS contamination at the site. And this means that for characterization of these PFAS plumes, it just may be beneficial to collect you know, soil samples so we can understand if the soil is contributing to groundwater that may have PFAS detections as well.
Thank you, Ryan. Chris, question for you. Can you please discuss the binding properties of various PFAS on a site and discuss this in relation to soil characteristics, relative mobility, adsorption to organic material, and potential release to stormwater?
Sure. So I'll just caveat this that, again, this is very much dependent on the type of PFAS that have been released. You know, we spend a lot of time talking about these HLF-impacted sites, and that's where I think most of the study has been done. And, you know, we already talked a little bit about relative mobility, but when you think about these firefighting foam-impacted sites, it's important to remember that some of these polyfluorinated substances can exist as anions, but also cations and bitter ions, and actually can stick potentially much more strongly to the soil than the perfluoroalkyl acids, which have been the most studied. So we wouldn't really expect them to necessarily be released to in a stormwater-type runoff scenario unless the particles, the soil itself, kind of is transported. But you would potentially expect the more soluble perfluoroalkyl acids to be released and transported. The various interactions with these perfluoroalkyl acids and soil organic matter, which is much more established for the longer chain length compounds, is discussed in the TechRag in 5.2.
Thanks, Chris. Appreciate having that reference there for us. And I guess another question for you, as we're talking about organic material, if these long chain PFAS can sequester in that organic material, can these PFAS then be released given any sort of changes in ORP, DO, pH, or other geochemical type conditions?
It's a great question as you start thinking about the long-term fate of these compounds that might be stuck in that organic material. There's not as much information as of yet. What I can say is that when we go to extract these compounds from soil to analyze for them, we tend to use a strong base that will help promote desorption of these compounds. So get them off the soil and out of the organic matter and into the solvent that you're going to then analyze.
Okay, great. Thank you, Chris. Hunter, if you can come on. We actually have two questions on this topic, specifically about PFAS and clay. So first, are there any effects of clay-rich soil on PFAS assessment and plume migration? And secondly, are PFAS more likely to bind to clay or to silt?
So this is a really sort of loaded question. I think it's first important to differentiate the effect of clay materials on the transport of PFAS in terms of whether that behavior is in the vadose zone, the unsaturated vadose zone, or the saturated groundwater zone. Within groundwater, I think the general effect of clays is to mitigate transport via this diffusion process. So any time there's this permeability contrast in the subsurface, the higher advecting flow through zones, you know, is representative of the bulk of water transport, but then that creates a concentration gradient across these clay-rich zones that for a lot of years create a forward diffusion effect and create a situation where the PFAS diffuse into those low permeability clays, and then eventually as the gradients reverse, that then creates a secondary source where these PFAS would then diffuse out of those clay materials. So it's not really an absorption phenomenon as it is a physical diffusion-based process. So I think the net effect of clay in the saturated subsurface is to overall mitigate transport simply by mitigating advective flux, but ultimately to serve as a reservoir of back diffusion, which would, you know, essentially sustain these groundwater plumes for much longer than they would occur otherwise. Now, in the unsaturated zone, the effect of clay is rather counterintuitive. You would certainly think that the clay materials would provide a greater source of absorption simply by virtue of that greater surface area. And indeed, a lot of the soil washing projects that have been conducted around the world have definitely seen, you know, greater concentrations within the fines simply due to that greater surface area. But with respect to transport, these clay-rich zones in the vadose zone, while they have a greater surface area, they often have much higher water contents, volumetric water contents, all else equal. And as we'll discuss momentarily, I think, this interfacial behavior where PFAS accumulate at these air-water interfaces, where that moisture content is higher, there is less air-water interfacial area, so the overall retention is actually less. And in fact, we demonstrated that with a publication last year from AFCEC's SI data. Thousands of sampling locations across hundreds of facilities across the country where we calculated soil to groundwater ratios and then tried to make sense of that variability as a function of the soil composition, we actually saw soils with higher clay content were observed with less retention. And again, that's most likely due to the fact that these soils with higher clay content in the vadose zone have much higher water contents, all else equal, and therefore less air-water interfacial area, and therefore less air-water interfacial uptake and retention. So I think clay is sort of a good thing, at least with respect to mitigating transport in the groundwater environment, at least initially. It's kind of a bad thing, ultimately, with respect to back diffusion. But clay is not necessarily a good thing with respect to mitigating transport in the unsaturated zone, simply because that eliminates a lot of this potential for air-water interfacial retardation. Thanks.
Great. Thank you, Hunter. Chris, question for you. Can you please discuss what is understood about the specific gravity of various PFAS and how that may impact the mobility in groundwater?
Sure. So I think it's really important to keep in mind that the PFAS that are of current regulatory interest are really all quite highly water soluble. So having information on the density or specific gravity of these compounds isn't really that relevant. There could be exceptions, of course. And you know, an example might be there might be pure phase release of things like fluoroethylamine alcohols, which can actually have some density differences and may act like a DNAP, dense sonic glucose liquid, if they're present. But you know, the vast majority of sites that are impacted by PFAS are really impacted by these more water soluble compounds, where the issue of specific gravity or density isn't really driving mobility. It's more about their ability to stick to things, such as what Hunter just described in terms of the clay and the air-water interfacial behavior.
Thanks, Chris. And so that air-water interfacial behavior keeps coming up, and I have a couple questions that I want to get to. But before I do that, I want to acknowledge, even though I'm trying to refer everybody to Chapter 11 or Section 11 of the Technical and Regulatory Guidance document for sampling information, I do want to ask this question, and I'm going to ask Ryan. Ryan, can you discuss what methods are available in general for PFAS analysis in soils? And more importantly, are there any concerns to be aware of when you're reviewing that data?
Sure. Typically, commercial labs in the U.S., they perform their own modified methods that are adapted from the published EPA drinking water methods to really perform analysis on other media such as soil. There are, you know, methods available to accommodate PFAS analysis in soil as far as an ASTM method that only uses a couple of grams of soil. I know high-resolution site characterization techniques that are specific to PFAS are currently limited, but there's research in that area to try to develop new techniques there. As far as drawbacks, I know one drawback that we mentioned in the site characterization section is the inconsistency of results related to the varying soil types and compositions.
Thank you, Ryan. All right, now Hunter, let's have you come back on and let's talk a little bit about that air-water interface. So is this issue considered as a significant predictor of fate and transport of PFAS?
So this air-water interfacial uptake retention mechanism for PFAS is an absolute game changer. It is almost single-handedly the reason why you cannot associate PFAS with the legacy, the conventional legacy contaminants that we're accustomed to dealing with, whether it be in a modeling domain or a regulatory construct. They require an entirely new paradigm of thinking, and you know that's why I'm sort of so specific that we have to let go of these conventional approaches and acknowledge the fact that we're dealing with a new class of chemicals that require a new class of management strategies. This air-water interfacial behavior has been demonstrated by researchers the world over to be a very significant retention mechanism, and in some soils could be the dominant retention mechanism. Dr. Martin Brousseau at the University of Arizona has done these really elegant unsaturated column experiments simulating vertical transport through an unsaturated vadose zone, and in certain instances has demonstrated that air-water interfacial uptake can represent as much as 80% of the total retention. And so that's why if you're using the conventional tools like V-Leach and or Hydrus, without that capability, the interfacial partitioning capability, you're potentially underestimating or you're potentially overestimating the mass discharge to groundwater by as much as 80%. And that is just not acceptable and requires a complete reboot of how we think about things. So I'll preface that by saying, you know, this is specific to vadosum transport. In the groundwater, you know, domain, like I said a minute ago, I think the basic advection dispersion equations apply. There's certainly potential for accumulation within the capillary fringe, but it's most likely a much less significant of a mechanism of retardation in the saturated zone than it is the vadosum.
Thanks, Hunter. Sandra, if you could come back on. You talked a little while ago about some leaching, so I want to ask this question to you. Certain EPA methods are used to test for potential leaching of contaminants from soil to groundwater, and I know these mentions are mentioned in the technical and regulatory guidance document. So can those methods be used to test specifically for leaching of PFAS?
Okay, so to kind of pivot off of what Hunter was just talking about, these methods are definitely the conventional methods that were developed really without PFAS in mind, so that's for sure. But can these methods be used to test for leaching of PFAS? Yes. These methods can certainly provide insight into the leachability of PFAS. We know that PFAS can leach from soils and impact groundwater. There's many studies of atmospheric deposition that show that atmospheric deposition moves through the soil and impacts the groundwater. So this we know. Right now, there are basically three generally used analytical leaching methods that EPA recommends. So you have the synthetic precipitation leaching procedure, or SPLP, the toxicity characteristic leaching procedure, or TCLP, and the leaching environmental assessment framework, or LEAF, which is a series of leaching tests. These and others may provide an idea about the leachability of PFAS from vadosum materials, but again, they weren't designed with PFAS in mind. PFAS having the unique qualities that they do, that needs to be considered when reviewing the results from these tests. As an example, in the very commonly used SPLP method used to determine the impact of a contaminant concentration in the soil to groundwater, a lab may use items during this method that either adsorb the PFAS, for instance, the glass fiber filters, or contribute PFAS, such as bottles that are not PFAS-free. So it's recommended that you talk to the labs and really review with a good QA to determine if issues such as these may impact your results. And this impact may be dependent on the level of PFAS contamination in your soils, with the results from the more contaminated soils not being biased to the same degree as lightly impacted soil. But overall, any method that's chosen should be appropriate for the settings and parameters that are present on your site, and always consider the end use of the data. So it does have some use. It can provide some insight. It is complex to predict the mass discharge of PFAS from vadosum soils to groundwater. So you may choose to use these tests along with modeling or direct measures of mass discharge, such as the use of lysimeters, soil lysimeters. But overall, these tests can be certainly useful. And just to note, there are some good studies going on right now that are evaluating these tests with the specific relation to PFAS. Jennifer Guolfo out of Texas Tech is doing a CERTIP ESTCP project that should contribute to our knowledge base on this issue. So we do expect to get more information on this in the near future.
Great, Sandra. And I think I just heard you say something I heard in our first roundtable on sampling and analysis. It's communicate with your lab, communicate with your lab, communicate with your lab, and really understand what your data quality objectives are. So thanks for bringing that up. I do have another question I'd like to send to you. Are the soil organic carbon water partition coefficients, those KOC values, are those available for the perfluoroalkyl acids, the PFAAs?
Generally, yes. We do have a lot of these values available in the literature. And notably, the literature does include a good representation of the anionic form of the compounds in determining the KOC. If we haven't already talked about this before, or we have referenced it occasionally, it is the anionic form of the compound that's generally found in the environment, because the pKa of these compounds is so low that the compound generally exists in the anionic state. This would mean that you're looking for the carboxylate or disulfonate form of the compound to determine this partitioning coefficient. The ITRC PFAS team has compiled a selection of representative KOC values taken from the literature and put it together in table 4.1, which is a great table. It has a lot of physical chemical properties in it, and it has a whole table just of KOC values. So we had some really amazing people reading the literature and pulling out these values and providing you with the reference of where it comes from. So you can always look back to the table to really, you know, zone in on what information you need about the KOC. And you will see that it's generally the anionic form of the compound that's contained in the table.
Thanks, Sandra. So for those values, right, that we have on the table, is there a lot of variability between those values? And I guess how much can environmental factors affect the KOC values?
So if you look at table 4.1, it does contain a pretty good overview of the physical chemical properties of PFAS and shows a good amount of KOC values. As the ranges go, you can see where there are more studies generally performed on the more well-known PFAS, such as PFOA and PFOS and PFUNDA, the lab-derived values are found to really kind of coalesce around a tight general range, relatively. But as all things PFAS, know that there are other site conditions that may impact how you expect that KOC value to impact migration. So it's not kind of the only coefficient, retardation coefficient that you really need to consider. What I mean is it's not really the environmental factors that impact the KOC, but other environmental factors may play a role in the PFAS partitioning and mobility on the site. So you need a more holistic review of retardation coefficients to really understand how the retardation is going to be impacted on that site.
Thanks, Sandra. And I think, Chris, would you like to come on? Do you have anything you want to add maybe to what Sandra just discussed?
Sure, yeah. So as I guess one of the people that published, I think, some of the first KOC values for some of these compounds, but I've been thinking about it for a number of years. And, you know, as much as we'd like to simplify things, it's really not as simple as KOC in that, you know, these are anions, and they are affected by solution chemistry, not so much that they're going to be protonated and behave as neutral forms, but rather the solution chemistry also affects the solid phases that these compounds are sticking to. So when you're thinking about the behavior of these compounds in saturated groundwater conditions, you really need to think about the things such as the pH, the amount of calcium. I think there was a question that came up about a salinity, how that might affect things in groundwater. And generally, the lower the pH, the higher the levels of cations like calcium or magnesium, and even potentially things like sodium, the stronger some of these compounds might stick to a solid phase. So, you know, that's something really important to keep in mind. I'll add that we think that some of that behavior might also be relevant for this air-water interfacial behavior that we've been talking about. And so I think there's going to be a lot more information on that as well. I'll add one last quick comment in that, you know, I think there's been emphasis on looking at field-derived values as opposed to lab-derived values, which I generally agree with, particularly because there is this concern about kinetics. And I think there will be a lot more information coming out in the not-so-distant future about how these compounds might be actually diffusing much more slowly out of material, and that has to be accounted for in these different types of models and understanding their phase transport.
thanks for adding on to that, Chris. I appreciate it. I know we're getting a lot of questions, so please keep them coming. I don't know if we're going to be able to get through everything, so just a reminder, we will have that digest at the end. So if you don't hear your question today, we will try to address it before we send out that Q&A digest. So, Sandra, could you please come back on for the next question? Which PFAAs, those perfluoroalkyl acids, bioaccumulate more, long chain, short chain, and why?
Okay, so there are a lot of studies around this, looking at a lot of different analytes and tissues that the bioaccumulation really is a concern for. But basically, the bioaccumulation patterns are driven by the structure of the molecule, which dictates its solubility and its partitioning. So the length of the carbon chain and the functional group largely impacts the magnitude of the bioaccumulation. The shorter chains tend to have a greater solubility and therefore will bioaccumulate to a higher degree in plant tissues, partitioning where the water collects in the plant. The portion of the plant where you will find the PFAS will vary greatly by the type of plant. The longer carbon chain PFAS have the ability to partition to organic material better, and they tend to be proteinophilic. So you will find that the long chains partition to animal tissues better, particularly showing higher levels in blood plasma and liver tissue. And note also that PFAS with a sulfonate group tend to bioaccumulate to a higher degree than carboxylate PFAS with the same carbon chain length. An example of that is PFOS, the 8-carbon chain sulfonate, is often seen as the compound of greatest concern when evaluating the bioaccumulation in fish and other biota. PFOS is a long-chain sulfonate. It's been widely studied. There's lots in the literature about it. And it is often detected in environmental media. It's been found to have a high degree of bioaccumulation. So that's kind of ahead in the compounds of concern of bioaccumulation.
Thank you, Sandra, for that information. I have questions on surface water and PFAS, and I'd like to ask this question of Chris. Chris, are PFAS expected to stratify in a lake or other type of surface water impoundment?
So the thing to keep in mind about these compounds is they are surface active chemicals. So they will, and one would expect, particularly for the longer chain length compounds, to enrich in the surface microlayer of a lake. I wouldn't necessarily expect stratification, like density-driven stratification in a lake, but you would expect them to be in more abundance in the surface microlayer. And I think this is briefly discussed in Section 5.2 of the TechReg document.
Thanks, Chris. Sandra, if you can come back on, let's stick with surface water bodies and where one would expect to find the PFAS. Sandra, what depth should be sampled in surface water?
So we do understand that PFAS is likely not well mixed in the water column, and it can vary depending on the levels of organic carbon in that portion of the water column, along with a lot of other characteristics, such as depth to sediment, scouring, types of sediments present. But that being said, it seems to be a commonly practiced method to take a grab sample from just under the surface at about 6 inches below the surface. That's what I found when I did my work. And while you may expect to get higher levels right at the surface due to the properties of PFAS and because of the organic material that may accumulate there, it's generally more comparable to other reported surface grab water samples, surface water grab samples, to collect this sample just under the surface. So it's really knowing what your endpoint is. It's always a good idea to consider your endpoint, thinking of the results that you're going to gather and knowing what you want to use it for and how you're going to compare it to other studies. So maybe your study would like to evaluate a maximum exposure to biota that hang out on the top of the surface water. Then maybe you'd want to modify your sample collection method. However, always make sure that there were special considerations for the sample collection, that you make that clear so that the data can be appropriately used.
Thanks, Sandra. And you actually made me think of one thing. I mentioned our future roundtable sessions that we will have. One of those is actually going to be on risk assessment. So if you have further questions about that and evaluating your data in light of risk to receptors, then we'll certainly try to address those there. And we are working, the ITRC PFAS team right now, on actually writing a new section or some new content for the guidance document that addresses a lot of questions about surface water quality, from what's needed to potentially develop standards, looking at potential foam formation on surface water bodies, and a number of other topics. So please stay tuned for that when we publish that next year. Ryan, I want to bring you into the surface water discussion for one more question. It seems like many of our PFAS spills migrate long distances in surface waters before entering a public water source. Is this typical or expected behavior nationwide?
So, you know, the reality here is that some PFAS plumes had years to develop and migrate without detection or characterization just due to these chemicals not being regulated or considered a health or even environmental concern. We mentioned in the site characterization section that because certain PFAS are mobile and resistant to breakdown in the environment, there have been cases of surface water creating large, dilute, groundwater plumes that can result in primary and secondary sources to groundwater. So therefore, you know, site characterization should consider whether or not surface water bodies are the most downgraded extent of contamination. And furthermore, having a conceptual site model will help identify potential ecological and human receptors, such as downgraded drinking water wells, creating that human exposure.
Thank you, Ryan, for your response. I'm going to ask this next question of Rula. Rula, for PFAS investigations, is it important to screen monitoring wells at the soil and groundwater interface? And are there any well construction materials that also need to be considered?
Thanks, Kate. Emma, there are two questions there. For the first one, I'd like to refer back to the great work that Hunter referenced about the potential. So, starting off, I think we can all agree that many PFAS by design preferentially form films at the water air-water interface. So what we're going to see is the hydrophobic carbon fluorine tail sticking out towards the air and the hydrophilic head group hanging out in the water. We don't specifically make recommendations in the TECREG about where to screen wells and whether to do it at soil groundwater interfaces because the state of practice, not science, the state of practice is still evolving. There is one project that is being done by Professor Jennifer Field at Oregon State University. It's a startup project which evaluates PFAS stratification in the water column as a function of different variables. And this project will evaluate PFAS accumulation at air-water interfaces, specifically in wells. And once that data is available, we hope to include it any relevant information in the updated TECREG. Regarding the second part of your question, I think it is safe to say that using well construction and sampling material that is PFAS-free is important to avoid false positives. Many purging and sampling equipment includes materials that may have some PFAS, pumps, balers, stopcocks can contain O-rings and gaskets that may be made of Teflon or another fluoropolymer. The most inert materials should be used whenever possible. We include recommendations to use stainless steel, silicon, and HDPE in the TECREG. And we also discuss materials and equipment that can be used in PFAS-focused investigations.
Thanks, Rula. Hunter, I have some questions. I want to go back to the air-water partitioning again. So we've talked about the air-water partitioning and that many PFAS are surface-active chemicals. So how important is this surfactant behavior in understanding PFAS mobility in the aquifer?
Yeah, so I think we've kind of danced around this response a little bit thus far, but there's certainly reason to believe or suspect that PFAS, all else equal, would accumulate within the capillary pharynx and not necessarily migrate vertically. However, that wouldn't preclude vertical stratification given, say, a vertical gradient advective fluxes that migrate vertically. And certainly there have been case studies that have demonstrated that concentrations within the groundwater table have been observed to increase with depth. But those published case studies have also observed an increasing gradient with depth as well. So the advective dispersion equations, again, stand. It's just characterizing those gradients are what's critically important here. So in the scenario where there is no vertical gradient and there is a very little gradient, you would theoretically expect these PFAS plumes to be very pancake-shaped, very flat, and to only exist right at the shallow water interfacial zone. However, I would say, how we interrogate the subsurface at most sites isn't necessarily that precise. We take grab samples at the water table with relatively sloppy drilling techniques. We screen wells across the water table with relatively large well screens, and then we purge those well screens, which facilitates sort of a preferential flow through the more effective depth intervals within that screen zone. Not only that, but we could use passive samplers that sit at the water table, and the PFAS concentrations within the well volume could stratify and sit at the water air interface, whereas within the actual formation, that might not necessarily represent the actual formation distribution. So I think it's important to keep in mind that how we delineate these plumes vertically and laterally isn't an exact science, and we're sort of, usually talking within feet, not necessarily inches that's germane to the capillary fringe. So I would say theoretically, yes, there is reasons to suspect that this air-water interfacial behavior would be germane to groundwater transport, but it's much less of an issue than it is relative to vertical vadozone transport.
So it sounds like then, it's not one size fits all, sampling the top of the water column versus sampling somewhere in the midsection of the well, to find those highest PFAS concentrations.
Maybe
how deep we have to go?
Well, right. So I certainly wouldn't condone drilling through a confining layer, an aquitard of sorts. But as we discussed earlier, there's these phases to site characterization. And, once you're at the full delineation stage, I think it is incumbent on us as investigators and practitioners to fully delineate that vertical profile. And the vertical aquifer profiling techniques have come a long way in recent years, such that I feel confident we can get, good vertical profile data in the saturated subsurface, again, to within feet sort of intervals of precision. So I do think it's a case where we continue chasing the vertical extent until either we, find the extent of the plume, or we encounter some impermeable zone and such that we're confident that provides a confining layer to any further vertical migration.
Thank you, Hunter. Sandra, I'd like to go back to bioaccumulation. Can you speak a little bit more about what information is available about bioaccumulation in plants and animals?
Oh, so much. There is more and more every day, and we still could learn more. But there's a lot of amazing work being done to understand the partitioning of the various PFAS compounds, which appears to vary based on which PFAS analyte you're considering and which part of what kind of plant or animal. So there's a lot to consider. In Section 5 of the TEC reg about the environmental fate and transport processes, there's a discussion on PFAS uptake into plants and animals. As an example for plants, some of the literature discussed includes a paper from Lindstrom in 2011 and Skutlarik in 2006 that looked at areas of applied industrial biosolids that provided a PFAS source to plants, and then these plants were fed to farm animals. In a study from China, from Shan in 2014, airborne emissions from an industrial site were found to impact PFAS concentrations in bark and tree leaves. And he theorized that the PFAS uptake in the leaves could be due to intake through the stomata. Andrea Blaine also published some very useful papers, multiple papers that cover investigations of plants exposed to PFAS from soil, groundwater, surface water, or air in proximity to PFAS release sites. Turning to animals, as far as bioaccumulation to biota, the literature list is very long. There are two tables that people can take a look at alongside the TechReg that compile these literature values for bioaccumulation, bioconcentration, and biomagnification of PFAS into biota and plants. So table 5.1 contains values collected for the biota, and 5.2 or 5-2 is a separate spreadsheet. They're both separate spreadsheets containing literature values for tables that for bioconcentration, bioaccumulation in the literature characterizing PFAS uptake into plants. These two tables are not intended to be comprehensive. There's a lot of literature out there. But these can provide a range of values and an overview of what values are likely to be representative of bioaccumulation in these media. And as you mentioned before, Kanema, the Fate and Transport Writing Group is currently working in tandem with the new writing group, the PFAS Surface Water Quality Writing Group, to provide a more comprehensive overview of bioaccumulation values for biota that can help us to understand the mechanisms that lead to bioaccumulation with the goal of protecting surface water quality. So we're looking at bioaccumulation in fish primarily. Those updates will be ready for our version 2 guidance document in 2021. So we'll come out with a bigger, more comprehensive table that reviews a larger portion of the literature. So there's a lot of information out there.
Thanks, Sandra. Those references are definitely handy now, and looking forward to see what we have compiled for next year. I guess as a follow-on question, Rula, are there studies on vegetation due removal of PFAS from the soils?
Thanks, Kadama. We refer to the removal or degradation of contaminants in soil and groundwater using plants as phytoremediation. And we will be covering a range of treatment methods for PFAS on the third PFAS Expert Roundtable, which will take place in early 2021. So contaminant removal from groundwater using phytoremediation is covered very briefly in the TechReg in Table 12. We conclude that the state of practice for PFAS phytoremediation is limited. To date, there is little evidence of effectiveness and no demonstrated capacity for practical use as of yet. There are also concerns regarding the disposal of the PFAS-laden foliage and harvested materials. So if you're interested in additional details, refer to Table 12 of TechReg or tune in early 2021 for our third expert roundtable.
Thanks, Rula. The next question is going to be for Hunter. Hunter, are there any case studies that you're aware of discussing PFAS characterization in wetland environments?
So Chapter 6 of the TechReg is devoted exclusively to published occurrence studies. It's a summary of all the case studies out there, at least in the published literature. And obviously there are a plethora of those case studies at this point, many of which document surface water either discharges or groundwater discharges to surface water, this GSI phenomenon. And I'll just highlight one particular case study that's referenced in that chapter that we published a couple years ago. We comprehensively studied a former fire training area at an installation with one of these FTAs near a water body, a surface water body, and documented a mass discharge to that water body at gram per year sort of levels. And that's really sort of indicative of this PFAS issue, these legacy, these groundwater plumes at these legacy fire training area sites really have these really dilute groundwater concentrations that result in far less discharge to surface water than conventional contaminants, where we're typically accustomed to talking about kilogram per year discharges. However, despite that de minimis discharge, we did observe elevated body burdens within the inhabitants of that water body, well within that impacted reach relative to upland or upgradient controls and a reference location from a different watershed. So that just sort of highlights the fact that these wetland environments, despite these really trivial, almost trivial and de minimis concentrations, can still result in elevated body burdens simply due to the persistence of these PFAS and their bioaccumulative properties, as everyone's already indicated.
Thank you, Hunter. So let's kind of stay on the same tune for a minute. Rula, are higher levels of PFAS typically observed in sediment as compared to surface water?
Thank you, Kate Emma. This is very site-specific and release-specific. Chapter 6 of the TECREG covers the occurrence of PFAS in various environmental media, including surface water and sediments, and we discuss different conceptual site models for releases and the specific impacts that we may observe based on these releases. PFAS are found in sediments due to atmospheric deposition, exposure to the impacted media, or direct discharge. It tends to be, the distribution of PFAS tends to be a complex in sediments, and again, it reflects site-specific factors, things like total organic carbon, the particle surface charge associated with the PFAS, and the phase interfaces. Properties of the individual PFAS, such as the alkyl chain length and the ionic functional group, these are also important factors. In sediments specifically, we tend to see PFOS, PFOA, and other long-chain carboxylic acids. Those are the type of compounds that tend to dominate in sediments relative to a broader range of compounds in surface waters.
Thanks, Rula. So is there a significant difference in the sediments to soil ratios of PFOS as compared to the sediment and soil ratios of PFOA?
Again, I think that's a function of the type of release and site-specific conditions. For example, if you have a release involving legacy AFFF or the older 3M light water foams, you tend to see PFOS present at much higher concentrations compared to PFOA. So it's a very much a function of the type of release and the site-specific conditions at a site. These are all really great questions, but it's hard to give a direct response because of all the factors that play into what the field observations, Kate Emma.
It's certainly all site-specific, it sounds like. So thank you, Rula. And we do have time. I think we're coming up on the hour. We have about 15 minutes left, so we're going to try to get through a few more questions before we wrap up. So, Rula, if you could stay on, please. I'm going to ask this question for you. Have you seen evidence of PFAS reaching downgradient areas across surface water bodies? And is there any truth to the idea that PFAS can either migrate below or underneath a surface water body?
That's a really good question. In the interest of time, I will keep it really brief. We've seen several cases showing that PFAS can migrate to downgradient areas across surface water bodies. In section 2.6.1 of the TECREG, we cite two references of PFAS releases to the environment involving surface water impacts and then infiltration, subsequent infiltration to groundwater. Other references to surface water bodies serving as secondary sources of PFAS in groundwater, specifically in the state of Minnesota, those are included in sections 2.6.4.2 and 10.2.1.1 in the TECREG.
Thanks, Rula. And I'm going to add on to that, the TECREG, since it is a web-based version, you can actually use the little search bar on the web page and type things in. So if you didn't jot down those sections quickly enough, you can certainly search based on topic to find the information in the TECREG. But, of course, we will put those section references in the digest when we're done with today's session. Chris, a question for you. Are PFAS degraded by UV in the atmosphere? And if so, what are the approximate half-lives of PFAS in the air?
So the important thing to remember about this class of compounds is that the vast majority of them don't have good chromophores, so they're not as good as absorbing UV light and undergoing direct photolysis, if you will. Similar to what we were talking about with respect to the polyfluorinated compounds, polyfluorinated substances being more amenable to transformation. There have been studies on the indirect photolytic oxidation of polyfluorinated substances in the atmosphere. So that has been observed, and there's a variety of different half-lives. I think some of those are tabulated in the TECREG section 5.4, if I believe. And But the, again, these are really just for the polyfluorinated substances where that has been observed.
Thanks, Chris. Ryan, here's a question for you. Is vapor a concern for PFAS, and is it supported by any references in the tech reg that document measured vapor concentrations in soil gas at PFAS release sites?
Well, in the tech reg, we do not mention references that document measured vapor concentrations in soil gas, but in section 5.2.4, we discuss PFAS partitioning to air. And, you know, generally PFAS are less volatile than many other contaminants. Our section 4.2 goes into physical properties such as water solubility and vapor pressures. And, you know, the vapor pressures of these compounds are generally low with high water solubilities and, you know, thus limiting partitioning from water to air. So, but as we know, the PFAS family has a wide universe of substances with different physical and chemical properties. So it's important to understand which groups or even subgroups of chemicals we are discussing in the context of potential vapor pathways. And, you know, one thing to keep in mind here is that there's a lack of, lab methods for air analysis. But as part of the updates to our sections, we will include any new peer-reviewed literature on the vapor concentrations in soil gas.
Thanks, Ryan. And I think what I want to do is, based on what you just said, I'm going to open up the floor back to Hunter and see if he wants to add anything about whether soil vapor should be considered when you're doing an assessment for PFAS fate and transport. But before I let you on, Hunter, I'm going to note that there's also a question about ambient air and potential inhalation issues for PFAS, but we're going to hold that question for our later roundtable discussions about risk assessment and just specifically focus on fate and transport assessments for vapors right now. So Hunter?
Yeah, thanks, Caitlin. So I think it's important to keep in mind here that, you know, PFAS are this, you know, extremely diverse class of chemicals, and certainly many of them are volatile, and there are clearly atmospheric emissions that are the result of various manufacturing processes, and that volatility from those atmospheric processes are germane to things like atmospheric transformation and all of those various processes that Chris just mentioned, ambient air issues that you just mentioned. But one thing to keep in mind here is that for most land-based applications of PFAS, so for example, AFFF in particular, these are almost exclusively, if not exclusively, charged species sort of by design. These chemicals are all either anions, cations, or zwitterions in the formulation, and that's specifically designed to create the films and to, you know, facilitate all of those inherent properties that, you know, PFAS have been used for the various applications. So if you couple that information with the fact that every one of these applications that have resulted in land-based contamination, these discharges have occurred at the land surface, right? We're not talking about buried tanks deep underground or in a basement somewhere. They're exclusively occur at the land surface. And so any volatilization, if there were volatile products within those formulations, would have long since, you know, off-gassed. And I do think there is some literature that suggests that some of these polyfluorinated transformation pathways can and do consist of volatile intermediates, but a lot of that research has indicated that those volatile intermediates are transient in and of themselves, such that they are produced, but then rapidly transform into some other more stable end product. So while I don't take the issue of soil gas dispersion completely off the table, I say it's very unlikely that, specifically speaking, AFFF impacted sites would ever result in a sub-slab soil gas accumulation of volatile PFAS to the point where it would potentially be problematic.
All right. Thanks, Hunter. I appreciate that. And I'd like to go in our last minute or two here to Chris. Chris, what characteristics of soil could indicate how PFAS will partition and impact the flow of groundwater? And is the presence of oxide surfaces notable?
So I think we've covered this a fair amount already, but I'll just kind of recap in that, you know, these compounds, as Hunter pointed out, the vast majority of the ones we're concerned about in soils and groundwater are anionic, cationic, or zwitterionic, so they're charged. And so, but they're also surface active molecules, and so there's some degree of hydrophobic partitioning, but there's also electrostatic interactions, and we discussed that in the way that, KOC, to the extent that as an indicator of hydrophobic partitioning, is important, but you have to consider things like pH and calcium and those sorts of things that may impact all of that. The role of metal oxides is not as well established, I think, but it's also because, you know, we've tended to focus on the longer chain compounds, which the KOC, the producing the organic carbon, is more apparent for them. So I do think there's going to be some additional work to be done to understand how those metal oxides play a role for some of these compounds, particularly when you have low organic carbon and, for example, the shorter chain length compounds. So, you know, I think there'll be a lot more to say in the future, but for the moment, it's really about things like the organic carbon content. And if you're talking about an unsaturated soil, to the extent, you know, have an air-water interface, I think those are really important things to consider.
Thanks, Chris. Let's see if we can get one more in here. Rula, are there any specialized techniques or approaches specific to PFAS site characterization? There was one question about whether rainwater or stormwater analyses should be considered.
Thanks, Kate. That depends on the type of site and the suspected PFAS release and the pathways. So, for example, at manufacturing facilities with air stacks and the potential for PFAS air deposition, sampling stormwater runoff may provide important information. So that would be definitely a useful analysis at a site like this. The same may be true at an airport or an oil and gas storage facility, where discharges of AFFF on a surface could lead to stormwater impacts. So again, sampling stormwater may provide a better picture of potential migration pathways.
Excellent. Thanks, Rula. And so I'm going to squeeze this last question in here because we did get a couple of questions about landfills. Sandra, for landfill leachate from municipal landfills, do we have any data on what levels of PFAS are present in that leachate?
We do. And let's see, the levels of PFAS in landfill leachate will obviously vary depending on what type of waste was disposed at that landfill. If it's an industrial landfill that has accepted materials related to the manufacture or use of PFAS, then you would generally expect a higher level of PFAS in the leachate. The ITRC team was able to review studies that looked at PFAS composition in leachate taken from several landfills. And you can take a look at table 17-3 in the back of the tech reg. You can see where in a study by Young in 2015, they found PFOA levels between 281 and 217,000 nanograms per liter, and PFOS between 1,200 and 6,000 nanograms per liter. The treated leachate still contains PFOA up to 206,000 nanograms per liter. In a study performed in New York, the concentration of PFOA in the leachate was 4,200 nanograms per liter. And certainly there are a lot more studies, and we expect to expand the coverage of more current literature in the updates due out in 2021.
Thanks, Sandra. And, you know, we do have a number of additional questions, but unfortunately we're not going to get through them right now, but they do talk about landfill gas and talking about waste determinations, additional questions about physical chemical properties, so please stay tuned for our digest. I think what we're going to do right now is I'm going to bring us to a close, so I'm toggle through here to my final slides, if you bear with me. I just want to say thanks so much to everybody for participating today, for the questions that we received. We hope that this was valuable for you, and we really do appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule to join us. And a very, very special thank you to our panelists for sharing your expertise and for your contributions to the ITRC PFAS team. So as a reminder, on the ITRC website, we do have the guidance document. There's some updated fact sheets coming soon and all the supporting documentation we talked about today. There's also a risk communication toolkit that you can find there for your use. And as you heard today, we are working to update the guidance document over the next year and a half. There's a lot of new and emerging information, a lot of different perspectives to consider as we're trying to pull this together, including, you know, questions and comments and concerns about development of a surface water quality section. So please stay tuned for that. As a reminder, if you have a question that came in that's not addressed in that current document or any of those materials we talked about, we will try to address that information as feasible in the upcoming revisions. So thanks again for your participation today. If you have questions, any additional questions, excuse me, or you'd like some further clarification on what we talked about today, please feel free to email us. You can see the web link there on your screen. We will have that digest coming soon in the next few weeks. We'll hope that you'll join us for our future roundtable sessions 3 and sessions 4. They will be in 2021. We'll confirm those dates when we have them available. And the last thing, as you can see here on the screen, there's a link to the feedback form. We really do appreciate and love, I guess, receiving your input. So please use that form. Please get it into us. We greatly appreciate that. And we'll try to use that feedback to further develop our future roundtable sessions. So thanks again for joining us today. I hope you all have a great afternoon.